طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week we present the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The entire program this morning is devoted to a presentation by and conversation with Dr. William Slaughter, a Cambridge psychiatrist who has been collaborating with health workers in Gaza and the West Bank for several years and serves on the board of the Gaza Mental Health Center Foundation. He just returned from an international health conference in Palestine. We sat down with Bill to talk about the conference and his work in the West Bank and Gaza.
Well, thanks, John, for this opportunity.
Well, it's good to have you. You've been here before.
Back again.
Which is great.
That must mean the issues haven't gone away yet.
No. I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, it was a recent time over in the Palestine-Israel area that I thought I'd talk about some. Might be interesting to folks, hopefully. And as I'm thinking of, there's also a real theme of bridging. You know, you and I were talking a minute ago about when we first met in 08, West Bank and 48 Israel, and trying to get into the Strip. But just... those of us who have more movement permissions or status, I think, can be part of that bridging.
Yeah.
There's been such a big uptick since you and I, that trip, in social media, obviously, also.
Yeah.
So there is a little bit more ability to, break barriers by Skyping and Facebook and so on. But and I think also, I don't know what your opinion is, but it just seems to me there's been a good uptick in folks being able to come, some people being able to get out from different areas over there and come do speaking tours and so on. I think that's been a little increased, which is good. Yeah, this was last November, and, one thing I've been involved in as working in healthcare is with supporting mental health colleagues in the Strip. My background's kind of two-part. One is the major, so to speak, is cross-cultural health with a minor on kind of political science, international Middle East, Arabic studies over the years. So I always try to combine perspectives when over there. The basic orientation I've always had on working with things is on social issues is kind of do what you can with your particular skills. And me trained in healthcare medicine, help in that way. But also think about the whole gestalt, especially in that area. What are we going to do? Keep treating individuals until the cows come home. Obviously, the whole regional gestalt needs to change.
Yeah.
We're trying to knit those together, like we're all
right.
trying to do. Anyway, so since 1990, the lead mental health, the first and then lead professional independent mental health program in the Gaza Strip, many people know is the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. First such community mental health program in the Arab world, it said. Founded by Dr. Eyad Asaraj in 1990, himself a refugee into the Strip from Beersheba. So when there's the kind of collapse or hardly any decent government functioning in that area with how contested that level of social organization is, kind of civil society groups really need to step up and fill the space. So with this linkage theme, for instance, rights, civil rights, human rights, and psychological, mental, overall well-being always really been holistically thought of by that mental health center.
Yeah.
So the conferences that we have every few years are always kind of joint mental health and rights conferences.
Yeah.
Now, that was number... Let's see, number four or five, where we spent time in 08 in Ramallah. And you remember we Skyped into the Strip then, so we did a little.
Right, we couldn't get in, so yeah. They Skyped out of Gaza, yeah.
That was just a couple years into the blockade.
Yeah.
And we did make it onto TV in the area with our push at the Erez Crossing to get in.
Yeah.
So we did a little bit of getting the word out there. But kind of worked, did some panels and all that with some people in and out. So we had a sixth conference a few years back, and this was the seventh, kind of international, as much as we can, human rights and mental health conference. Now this one had a real good, from a Boston perspective, had a real good component where psychologist at UMass Boston, Devin Atullah, Dr. Atullah, you know, really arranged for a Skype site here at UMass.
Oh, good.
Yep. And then there was one on the West Bank with some really leading folks there, longtime activists, Rita Giacomin, Nadia Shalit Kevorkian, and so on. And then the main site in Gaza City. So some of the sessions were kind of cross-boundary Skyping to kind of build solidarity, if you will, but mostly Gaza City. These conferences there, 4 days. I have the schedule in front of me here. I'll read some of the titles. Are a combination of things. Now we say international, but most folks from outside the Strip, outside Palestine, are not able to get in, not permitted. Some of us are let in. There are probably maybe five people, lead Italian researcher, two Swedes who've been helping in the Strip for years with some really community-based training. And let's see, another American woman. That's what I can think of right now. But
you were able to get in.
Yeah, this time I was lucky again. It's about two-thirds of times that I try that I'm able to. Not all the time, but...
But just quickly, what did you have to go through to get a visa? And how long did it take?
Yeah, there's two levels of getting into the Gaza Strip. Now, some people go through Egypt and Rafah, but there's mm-hmm. a lot of... fighting with the Egyptian military and so on, Israeli military support, as I understand it. So I just don't feel safe going from Cairo to the southern end of the Strip. The northern end, where we were some years ago, that's called Eretz Crossing. And that's a big Israeli bunker, to go through, as you know. So to get through that bunker from Israel or 1948 Palestine into the Strip, first thing you have to do, of course, is get into historical Palestine-Israel from Jordan or at the airport. Yep. And as you know, they've been blocking more and more people. So that's a challenge right there. So many of us are shifting to flying into Jordan, and if we're not allowed in at the border, then to spend time with the huge Palestinian community in Jordan that's mostly impoverished and economically disadvantaged. Jordan is the one compartment over there, so to speak, with the most Palestinians. About a third of Palestinians are in Jordan. But anyway, you got to get in somewhere through the airport or over from Jordan.
Which way did you go this time?
This time I did go through the airport. I had Gaza vetting to get into the Strip. That's the second step. Mm-hmm. Deeper background checks and so on that can take longer. So I was fairly confident of getting through the airport.
In the Israeli airport, yeah.
Yeah. And showing the Gaza entry paperwork this time worked to get through the airport. When they see that, sometimes they say, well, you've had the deeper amount of vetting so you can go through. But certainly there have been folks who've been deeply backgrounded and have permission to get into the Strip but are bounced back at the airport or the river. So there's a lot of unknowns there.
It's really difficult.
You know, and that's with the privileged position that I have of, born American, passport, white, less colorism and so on. Mm. But obviously the Palestinian Americans are screened out at the airports a lot of times, as you well know.
Yeah, but and certainly the number of times you've been over there, they know who you are, they have a record,
Just never know.
Yeah.
You never know. But it's good to, have as many contacts as possible and, be focused on positive things like training and well-being and all that. So anyway, made it one more time. This conference was highlighting all the the knowledge and experience of our colleagues in the health and human service field in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
They are, of course, leading global experts on what it's like to be in severe ongoing trauma. No PTSD there, no post-traumatic situation. So a main reason for this is for the different groups there to kind of showcase and talk to other people in the Strip about what they've been doing. Now, with the gasoline and energy and so on challenges in the Strip, you know, just 25 by 5 miles roughly, in U.S. terms, we think, well, we can drive around and go from one end to another. Yeah. And it is possible usually, but with the degree of impoverishment, 54% I last looked were below the poverty line. Many people in the Strip just aren't able to move around much. So having, a session, this is in Gaza City, to come to for a couple days is a real, kind of anomaly for them. And so part of how I think of conferences like this, in addition to showcasing how people are working with people, showcasing research that they're doing, is also just frankly that idea of caring for caregivers on a collective basis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, come meet some of your colleagues that you went to school with, haven't seen for a while, catch up on who's doing what family members unfortunately sometimes have been lost and so on. So a little bit of a caring for the caregiver, if you will. Mm-hmm. So very meaningful. So some of the main themes now are unfortunately worsening suicide rates and also substance use and then continuing trauma.
Yeah, this is a society we're pretty safe to say the whole society's traumatized. You know, you don't go through what these people have gone through without suffering a great bit. Yeah,
it's absolutely true. There are different studies that focus on different kinds of trauma and so on, but basically everybody has been through something.
Yeah.
As you know, there's really no place to flee when there are attacks or leave at all, other than the very few privileged folks who are able to get out once in a while. So this time I was really proud of the Lead Mental Health Center. They're really highlighting really difficult topics like the addiction and suicidality, especially. You know, in any culture, those are not the conversation starters we like to lead with, of course. But important really to get at, and that might be even more so in some of the conservative cultures. But those were the highlight sessions, if you will, just started with those and big plenary sessions, which I think was really important to get out there in public health ways. And that's really been developing in the Strip over the years, acknowledgement of those kind of problems. So some of the typical titles were things like psychosocial concerns in a context of prolonged political oppression, Gaza mental health providers' perceptions. So again, going deeper into what it is to live in and serve people with trauma. Cyberbullying, that was getting more attention then, even in the Strip.
That's an issue there, yeah.
Yep, and it's relationship to anxiety and depression and school-age kids. Let's see, those are some... here's a dream study that was there. That makes me want to segue for a minute, John, into trainings there. My main focus usually is on doing some trainings with colleagues there. I don't have enough Arabic to work with people, very, very little actually. So I'm working with the providers who have English. The number one requested training over the years in the Strip is what to do with kids with embedded, entrenched trauma nightmares, repeat trauma nightmares. So we covered that, and basically techniques to support kids in drawing out, once they've developed some rapport and some trust with a counselor or a family member involved, to kind of draw out what the nightmare is. And you can imagine there a big part of that has to do directly with military attacks, or sometimes it's, in more metaphorical terms, a monster and so on. But I'd say of what I've seen of the drawings, clearly over half just very direct. Here's the drones, here's the helicopters, here's the infantry, and so on. Limbs coming off, a lot of things like that. Anyway, clarify what the nightmare has been. Spend some time over some weeks usually of thinking, how would I like things to change in good ways? And then really emphasizing that over time. And even in that area that has not moved on, we haven't figured out a way globally to support change, root change towards rights in the Strip, an individual sometimes can get some relief from chronic nightmares in that way. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. Suicidality was something I touch on each time, but that was really something they wanted highlighted this time. Now, Gaza Community Mental Health Program, in addition to being the biggest pool of seasoned, professionally trained mental health workers, about 70 staff.
Oh, 70.
That's, yep, 70 now. They're able to afford that. I'll just segue and say that one of the biggest challenges is that with such challenges globally and in the Middle East field, of course, since the we attacked Iraq and then that spilled into Syria and so on, a lot of the very strapped donors have moved some money into other regional refugee work.
Yeah.
So Gaza Community Mental Health continues to be able to field 70 staff, even with major budget constrictions and things like that.
Do you have... I was there... the only time I was there was in 2001. I got into Gaza and went to the mental health center. We went over with Nancy Murray.
Yeah.
Do you have sort of satellite clinics throughout the Strip?
Yeah. That mental health center has, let's see, two other brick-and-mortar ongoing offices in the Rafah and Khan Yunis in the mm-hmm. south of the Strip, but then a lot of outreach, a lot of some temporary sites during particular mm-hmm. high-level trauma periods and so on. Their main function, in addition to, is to kind of be, I call it the mental health backbone of the Strip, with the biggest pool, longest history of providing services like this. They, in many ways, try to reach the whole population. So public health campaigns around, acknowledging suicidality, acknowledging domestic violence, which is with the environmental violence there regionally, creeps into every, seam of society. All societies, of course, have some domestic violence, addiction, so on, but those tensions are driven into families. Also coaching and training the lesser trained healthcare providers, so primary health clinics in the two big systems, government and the UN, and then small groups, different women's groups and general medical groups that want to have some mental health training and so on. So being kind of a training center to push out the knowledge as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And having those organizations do as much of the support as possible, and then high-level cases that are really very difficult to deal with in Gaza Community Mental Health Program would take on clinically, and the higher level challenges. Mm-hmm. So that's their basic role there. In the Strip, very similar to us here with our opiate crisis, it's specifically opiate drugs that are the biggest scourge there. And that's been true for some years now. It's been good to see that gradually that's more acknowledged in public health campaigns and so on. So some real progress there, I'd say. But, the big indicators are still dismal and getting worse. I had a WhatsApp today from a friend in the Strip just saying, yep, we're still, he was talking about water in particular, as some small kids. So the famous 95% at this point, undrinkable.
So it's all mostly bottled, which I imagine is expensive.
People who can afford it, do have some bottled water. There's bigger canisters. UNRWA does the UN does what it can. And a lot of people are just flat out drinking difficult water.
Oh, geez.
It's very bad. And that, contributes to illness and so on. I was talking to one World Health guy who was there in the Strip, and he's going by World Health Organization standards about water safety with kind of under 300 contaminants or particles per million being kind of the best water and so on. They have levels there where they have different kinds of contaminants in the water up to like over 700 or so. So just kind of off the scales in a lot of ways. We're lucky here in Boston to have the Water Alliance, really focused on getting out public information about that. So just in terms of acknowledging, you know, good things and bridging, if you will, between, you know, different areas, I really want to, you know, praise them and them getting the word out. You know, one of the odd things about the Strip is inside, looking out to the areas that were lost to Palestinians in 48, became the State of Israel, it's all green around. It's almost all green, agricultural land and all that. And then immediately inside the Strip, there is some agriculture here and there, but the color contrast is really remarkable.
Yeah.
And you can see some of that on some satellite photos. If you have Google Maps and so on, and kind of drill down on the Strip, you can see some of the outlines there in that way. So that's clearly, you know, a water issue. And, of course, the Israelis have more technology and, you know, surrounding the Strip and do a lot of water mining. You know, you can call it taking water.
That was very visible in 2001 when there were still Israeli settlements on the Gaza Strip. You'd go and the settlements were green and lush and greenhouses and, you know, the whole thing, and then the rest was very desolate.
Well, exactly. It's continuing that way. You know, there's so many mental health issues that, you know, we're talking about, but I think sometimes in terms of the famous Maslow's hierarchy of needs, for everybody who had high school psychology, you know, the psychologist Abraham Maslow, with the bottom level of the pyramid being just basic physical health, good things like air and nutrition and so on. And, you know, those are so distressed in the Strip that, you know, we focus on all levels, of course, and do what you can, but you know, just in that environment, it's very difficult.
Yeah, it's survival mode,
Back to, on that basis of the pyramid, if you will, again, you know, when you've been to your child's healthcare visit, you have kind of normal growth curves. Those are those curves where there's kind of a normal line of height getting bigger, and then there's little dotted lines on either side, which is kind of the normal range, you know, kids a little taller, a little shorter, and all that kind of thing. We call it stunting in healthcare, where kids are more than twice the normal amount shorter than normal. And there is that's from lack of nutrition and other stressors. In the U.S., unfortunately, as we know, with our socioeconomic issues, there is stunting in the U.S., maybe 1 or 2% of kids, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We've got our work to do here if we can bring some of that money back from the Middle East. In a region there, nearby, Jordan's about 8% stunting. That's probably the best in the region. But in the Strip, it ranges from 9 or 10% up to 30% of kids just are below growth rates. So they're going to much higher rates for early death, much higher rates for different illnesses to come on when their body is just not as robustly developed, some cognitive damage, things like that. There's an excellent study in 2013 out of Case Western Reserve that came up with those numbers. So even below the mental health part, of course, is just basic survival there. And in the midst of it, of course, just ongoingly really decent people and welcoming and, you know, all those values. So it's that whole mix. But, you know, over the last few years, I've heard more of a trend to say, yeah, you know, we've measured, we've studied, we live resilience. And also, we're not superhuman. You know, this is going on for quite a while.
No, it wears.
Yeah. And one of the local jokes there from some of the quarter of people are from families that were in the Strip before 48 are not refugees. And their joke is, you know, we welcome them. We did what we could. It's been kind of going on now. Maybe they want to go home, so to speak, that kind of thing. I'll use that to segue into the return march there. It just happened while I was there that it was a Balfour anniversary of that promise from the British in kind of working World War I dynamics and Middle East dynamics, making a big promise there to the Zionists about a homeland in the area and so on. You know, that march has been going on about, coming up on 2 years now. there has been increasing conflict there, as everybody knows. I think it's over 300 deaths now. I think we're up to 12,000 injured, many leg injuries especially, and a lot of amputations, which is yet another factor swamping the healthcare system in the Strip. That particular day was just quite nice, a brilliant sunny day. There are five specific areas around the perimeter of the Strip, one for each county, so to speak, where people go to the fence and want to go home outside of the Strip. There's been some evolution from early on in the march, I understand, to a lot of overt showing of where people are from outside of the Strip. So there, early on, there were tents for extended families from Ashdod, just, you know, 15 miles, whatever it is, north of the Strip, from Al-Majdal or Ashkelon, just in eyesight of the Strip, north of the Strip and things like that. Big kind of tents where people who are from those areas could go there and kind of meet cousins and other people they don't know and so on, Beersheba, Ramla, Jaffa, things like that, some family tents. So quite an overt showing, if you will, of it's not called the Great March of you know, anger or something like that. It's called the Great March of Return, Al-Auda. That's the purpose. But there's been some falling away of that, a lot of logistics to keep going there. And with the increasing attacks and violence, you know, some of that having everybody come down, the grandmothers and everybody, that's, you know, can be quite challenging, of course. But that particular day, there was that feel again. There were speeches about, you know, the Balfour anniversary, about return and so on. I didn't stay for all of that. I was there for maybe 45 minutes or so early on during the day. But just wonderful to see the community turnout. So, now that was the... Now, I'll just say that an example of people coming over more to the U.S. was the, you know, originator of the march, Ahmed Abdurrahima, doing a speaking tour through American Friends Service Committee, was about a year ago or so. And his vision of seeing birds fly over and thinking, well, what about us? You know, we're from out there. It's so green. I've heard stories. You know, I can be on Facebook, maybe with a cousin in Jaffa, with some of the few Arabs left in 48, well, 20% of the population. You know, having that real return focus poetically. So, you know, kind of that spirit was very strongly there, kind of an art, if you will, or yearning in so many ways. Just this week, Monday of this week, that was the 20th of January 2020, I had kind of a reminder of some of the, you know, if we're talking about bridging and co-work, you know, as a theme, I was thinking of some of the barriers. It just, you know, getting my pants on or something, getting ready to go to work on Monday morning, and there was a piece on NPR that was from a reporter inside the Strip. He was framing some things as positive, a few folks in the Strip getting permits to go into 48 Israel to work, a church group setting up a field hospital and so on, and one just inside the Strip. It was positive or not, you can debate that back and forth, but it really struck me that the reporter was doing what they often do when he's reporting on people who are speaking languages other than the English that we have. You could hear in the background the guy speaking. The man was talking in specifically in Arabic about the Great March of Return. Bad Arabic, Al-Masira, Al-Auda, Al-Khubra. And that was translated as the protests. The protests. The voiceover in English. And it just really struck me that we get this image in the West of, you know, fighting at the fence and the burning and the smoke bombs and the drones and tear gas and all that, which is going on. But from a perspective of people involved, again, it's not let's go to the protests, it's let's go to the return march. That's the fundamental idea that's there, and that's just not been able to penetrate yet our collective consciousness adequately. Of course, there's more of us you know, that are working for justice and so on over there in the U.S., there's clearly been an uptick. But still, you know, to have that mistranslation about the return march to becoming protest, to me that's almost trivial. I mean, that is trivializing. Just any old protest. If I were and had a sandwich board outside Cambridge City Hall and, you know, protesting a tax increase or something like that, it's real different. It's just so hard across those barriers. So you got to keep trying. You've been a leader in that for years, including with this radio program.
Let me ask a question about the mental health center. I'm wondering how people get trained. I mean, people can't go in and out of Gaza. Where do you get your professionals from, and how are you training people within the camp to do mental health work?
No, really good question. You know, I see my role always is to let Palestinians speak for themselves. You know, we supported some leaders coming to the U.S. By Skype. That's secondary. You know, I will say something now on the third level without any leaders being here right now. But, you know, a few people have got have had professional training outside the Strip. Principally Europe, sometimes in Cairo or in Jordan are the primary ones. So there are some people that have that training. And there are some healthcare training schools in the Strip, Al-Azhar and Al-Quds University being the first that come to mind, and some other smaller ones, with some basic medical and healthcare training there in the Strip. But you're right, there is no then, that would be kind of like bachelor's equivalent or something like that. But then there's no real higher level training in psychology and psychiatry and so on. So it has been, Gaza Community Mental Health Program for years has had their, call it the higher diploma course of advanced, you could say graduate training, maybe similar perhaps in some ways to psychiatry residency or that kind of thing. But it's also true that in that, you know, much lesser resourced, including medications, much fewer choices. You can see the pharmacies there is kind of having a third of their shelves with things on it and stuff like that. But it's basically the folks who've been lucky enough to have higher level training outside being the trainer of other folks there. And then when you are lucky enough to get in anybody else from the outside, then to do that with their areas of expertise. In addition to that, I'll just say that that's what, you know, the training like that is what we do. In addition, there's a subtext of caring for caregivers.
Yeah.
You can imagine, they call it secondary trauma on. When I and my family, one might say, had some people killed, and then I turn around and I'm serving others with dozens of others, scores of others with you know, similar thing. Sometimes in my imagination when I'm there, sitting with these real hero colleagues, I almost see them with accreted burdens on their bodies. You know, almost like, I don't know what, but shells or something on their body of so many stories that they're carrying around. So part of what the healthcare folks there really need to do is support each other in their own kind of debriefing, listening, caring, being friendly with each other as much as they can, given, you know, any human dynamics and that kind of thing. And then when folks do come from the outside that aren't in as much trauma, you know, when I go in, I have different issues going on, but I have nothing like that, their level of trauma. It can be really helpful just sit with people and you know, let them again tell their stories and that kind of thing. So that's another kind of aspect of training, if you will. I will say deep training in doing real involved trauma work. They're the experts there, and you know, that's how we work it.
I can't help but sort of think of the work of our friend Ketam Edelby, who's an expressive therapist. She's almost has her PhD, but and she studied here at Lesley, but she's, I mean, the whole idea of expressive therapies is to release those traumas and things, and she's trying to do it at the educational level so that this gets into school, so it gets, it's part of a curriculum almost. I don't know if she can do that, but because expressive therapies is pretty new over there,
But that's exactly what she's struggling with, is trying to deal with sort of wholesale trauma, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That brings to mind a story from one time there. I'll say first that if God's Community Mental Health Program is kind of like a pool of deepest train, backbone, if you will, of mental health on the Strip, the big health systems, the government and UN, have gradually over the years been providing some more screening and some services and so on to try to reach the whole population.
Yeah.
And then there's smaller groups that do what they can with small grants, geographically limited within one camp or one school. In the big sprawling middle area, they call it, of the Strip, a camp called Nusrat, Mukhaim Nusrat, maybe 5 years ago, taken to one of the UNRWA schools, which is double shifted, of course. There's the morning shift, and around midday, I was there at midday, so just huge number of kids, some going home, some coming there. Some schools have been triple shifted, apparently, but I think double shifting's the norm. Anyway, the outside organization did come in and do some psychodrama there. And it was, I'm glad you brought this up.
Yeah.
The psychodrama was of kids experiencing what it's like to be in the Strip when they're under attack. And the counselor was having kids act out some things of where they'd been with their family, where they tried to hide.
Right.
Talk a little bit about what thoughts came up and could they do anything differently. One of the kids then, when there's a group of them discussing, he threw himself on top of the group and just said, "Missile, missile." So he would just, in his distress, you know, acting just like that. And that's really stayed with me, of how deeply these things are obviously taken in. You know, I know Khatam has that, if I remember right, the bus that she's taken around in the West Bank. That's just remarkable.
Yeah, she's going into veteran camps and things like that.
Yeah.
And training the mothers, training the folks. And the other interesting thing is what she's finding is working with young boys who've been in prison. This is in she's in East Jerusalem, who've been in prison, really, really traumatized kids that have been in prison. You know, sort of, we'd say, you know, really tough kids are really. And you'd think something like expressive therapies they might not buy into, but these boys just get into it, and a fabulous effect on the whole family. And so what you guys are doing is...
That's the colleagues there that are really the leaders, and the whole population, of course. Do we have time, John? I'd like to say something about inside 48 Palestine, Green Line Israel, so to speak. You know, when I was there, I keep main focus on the Strip because I just happen to have the right credentials and so on to get in there, which is unusual and all that, but always try to spend some time around the other areas there, just to, again, kind of co-work across boundaries, see what can be brought back to the U.S., see who wants to come on a speaking tour, stuff like that. So this time I checked in with a number of groups, but a couple that stay with me are some of the One Democratic State groups who have long seen the writing on the wall or the maps where it's kind of hard to say where a two-state border is going to go. You know, that's...
That ship has sailed.
long time ago, it seems like. But I will say, you know, it's always struck me that to American ears, folks that don't know the geography, don't know the situation, that sounds wonderful. Two states, one for each people. Balanced, 50-50, two states, equal, fair. We're supporting it, so isn't that fair? Isn't that our value?
Including all of our legislators, by the way. They all are still buying into this two-state thing.
It's, So, you know, I try to meet with people a lot of different orientations there, but love to meet with people sequentially over years just to kind of keep up and have those friendships and get a sense, I'm usually there once a year, of how things have evolved and all that. So a couple of the one state activists I like to meet with, one up in the Galilee area involved with one of the four Arab parties there. So checking in with him again, checking on how those activities are going. He's noting how difficult things are, of course, being Palestinian in Gaza, in Israel proper, so to speak. But working alongside, of course, with equality-oriented Jewish folks, we're still there, still doing strong work under more and more pressure from their government. Things that he was doing were some joint presentations in some of the predominantly Arab towns, bringing in some of the Jewish activists as well. Did some stuff with Ilan Pape and Sahnin, one of the big Jewish, Palestinian population centers in the north. He's talking a lot about this issue of how do I, he said, as a Palestinian, you know, where it's deep in me, kind of the Palestinian viewpoint, national project, if you will, you know, what's it like to be working with my dear Jewish colleagues, as he put it, very sincerely, you know, the folks who've been working for equality for a long time there. So that just got me thinking to these issues of kind of working across ethnic lines, little different orientations, you know, just how do you keep practicing that? And there's certainly leaders over there with that. He talked about trying to outreach more into the big refugee populations on the West Bank, but also Jordan, you know, Jordan, one-third of Palestinians, about 5% of Palestinians are just over the hills there in Lebanon. You know, so different social media, how to build more relationships and how to start talking about the future and where are we going with a real one state, you know, with right of return if you choose, that kind of thing. So it's just tremendously hopeful to me to keep seeing the folks who are right there, boycott from the inside people, you know, doing what they can do and so on, right in that very difficult place there. So that was fun to see him. He made a point, by the way, there's this question of if the roughly 20% of Palestinians in Israel, should they participate in the national elections or not? So he was, you know, bringing up this issue. There's been, my understanding, again, without good Arabic, is that a lot of Palestinians have been arguing for boycott. Why participate in this government that's you know, as it is, or even the whole system, of course. But when I was there, it was just after the second vote, if you will, last year, where about two-thirds of Palestinian people who are eligible in the current governmental system up there to vote for, you know, the Knesset and that, about two-thirds had voted. The prior one, election number one, was about 40%. Okay? And John and I are recording this in late February 2020, and there's an election coming up in March, so we'll see what happens with that deadlock. But his point was that, yes, it was odious to take part to some extent in a governmental system there, but you know it's well known that that surge in the joint list Arab vote in that second election did you know just push things so that Netanyahu doesn't have sole power, you know, and all that. Although now Gantz has talked about annexing the Jordan River Valley as well, so any of that, of course, is very difficult. But, you know, it's always interesting to hear about that struggle, about what to do there. So one other thing I'd like to highlight, one state for people interested in that, in those kind of different groups, different one state strains, if you will. Some are focusing on potential new government structure. You know, Jeff Halper has been an amazing bridge between the U.S. and Israel. His house demolition work and, you know, really focusing on one state solutions. So many talks in the U.S. and getting out some modeling bicameral kind of future governments and so on. Other ones have focused on other areas, kind of on more joint local work currently between Jewish folks and Palestinian folks and so on. So there are different, you know, strains, of course, of one state thinking and all that. I was happy to hear from another friend about a brand new kind of group, maybe a few months old now, One State Foundation. One State Foundation. And if you Google, I can't remember the URL right now, but I think it has foundation in it. The point of that group is not to start yet another one state strain, so to speak, since those are well covered, but rather to take a position that supports anyone who's thinking along those lines, any of the different trends or threads of one state development, and provide a fund for some people from any of those strains speaking abroad. So for instance, you know, if someone's a leader and there's some conferences and so on in Europe, to do some funding for getting plane tickets and hotels and so on, just to not take an exact ideological position on one state, but to support any of that dialogue. So I just want to bring people's attention to that, too. On the part about bridging and co-work, John, I'd like to say a couple things about the U.S. now.
Okay.
What we're doing here, so many people. You were talking about Khitam serving kids who are or have been in prison.
Yeah.
You know, the brightest light in some ways on the horizon is that 2407 House resolution now, the McCollum bill.
Right.
Promoting human rights for Palestinian children living under Israeli Occupation Act. That's a short title. You know, that's the, my understanding is that's the first positive in the sense of not trying to decrease the pipeline of funding that's going to Israel, but rather to intentionally carve out something positive. We will no longer have our funds involved with the child detention.
Yeah.
You know, it's usually 600 kids or something average per year under 17 that have been detained and so on. So I think that that's real exciting. You know, others other than me know a lot more about it. But, you know, Defense of Children International, I think, has taken a lead on that along with McCollum's staff. We're quite accessible if you're in D.C., you know, ask for meetings and support that. Some of the things that are explicitly mentioned in there. Now, some people on that have said, well, you know, the ongoing argument, why Israel? Why only Israel? So that the way that this act is written is of great interest to me because it does have Israel in the name, which I take as important because of our role in supporting the current structures over there. And with the huge influence that that area, that small area, has over the whole world, such a nexus there, I think it's important to have a focus in the U.S. on writing our policies to towards that area. And also, of course, all societies have their challenges. So the bill also has just clear language extending the so-called Leahy laws, which have been in place for some time, which means to take away U.S. Military funding to parts of militaries outside the U.S. that have been particularly egregious with atrocities. Mm. Right? There's additional couple paragraphs that will be added to that with this 2407 McCollum bill, just narrowing in on kids specifically, on specific acts like hooding, stress position, torture, death threats like that, not just for Israel, but for any society. So there's what I think is an important tandem by acknowledging all cultures, all people have problems, there's no doubt about it. You know, Israel-Palestine is no different in that way than everywhere else. And also, it's a critical nexus that in some ways does rise again above some other levels. Right. And we're obviously the number one supporter of that, so our responsibility there. One way that I think in the U.S. now, so the part of those of us lucky enough to go over there, like, you know, you and Kathy have been there and many of us, but what to do in the U.S.? Broad advocacy, speaking up like your radio show, like more and more voices, more and more groups coming on board over the decades now is very exciting. You know, standouts, events, speaking, podcasts, everything. But, you know, the center of advocacy, I see it as lobbying. You know, that's trying to influence directly specific new laws at local, municipality, county in some cases, state, and then, of course, in Congress. So how to keep a focus on lobbying in context of broad public information growth that clearly is needed in this area and that so many people are working on. So just to, you know, your radio show that we're doing right now is great on advocacy. Some leaders had a Science in Palestine conference a couple weeks ago at MIT. Excellent speeches there. And just a general increase in activities. You know, on the state level, of course, there's the push for anti-boycott boycott suppression in the U.S. states now, of course. I forget how many are up like that, but of course, the coalition of excellent leadership groups here in Massachusetts has so far successfully pushed back against that, mm-hmm. so that we here, in memory of the Tea Party, perhaps, and the deep history of protest in the U.S., and might try to keep some boycott rights here going in the midst of a mm-hmm. rights onslaught. So that's an example of kind of state level. Regional level, laws aren't made regionally, but a lot of networking and advocacy can be done regionally. Here, I think particularly in small state areas, you know, New England has six states. So we have the New England Network for Justice mm-hmm. in Palestine. Anybody interested? That URL is real easy, nenjp.org, with number of affiliate groups. If this airs before February 8th, 2020, we have a regional meeting there. Check on the mm-hmm. website. It's kind of a not coordination, because these are freestanding affiliate groups that take no particular ideological stance regarding Palestine-Israel area other than working towards justice in that area. Okay. So kind of an information sharing and so on across six states. Mm-hmm. And then a national strength I'd like to mention is the coming group American Muslim for Palestine, AMP sometimes. They've been doing an advocacy day in D.C., so you could call that lobbying directly within the Beltway there at Congress. I think they're coming up on 10 or 12 years now. And what that is a day or two of training in a D.C. area, a hotel, kind of basic Palestine-Israel information for people who are new, and then specific advocacy and lobbying information and kind of trainings. And then a day of kind of flooding the hill, having as many meetings as possible. Yeah. Last year, there were 500 people there. That's coming up 22nd to 24th March this year. They're hoping to double it to 1,000. It's quite affordable, so I urge any listeners to take a look at that and come on down across ethnicities. I'm not Muslim myself, but they're quite inviting. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Great. Well, we're up against the clock, and I don't want to end without commending you for what you've been doing. You've been in this a long time, and we really appreciate what you're doing, and we appreciate your coming on This Week in Palestine and sharing your thoughts with us. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, John.
You have been listening to a conversation with Bill Slaughter, activist and psychiatrist who works collaboratively with healthcare workers in Gaza and the West Bank. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.